Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Tracy Lee Simmons. Tracy actually is a long-time, well-known classicist in the public sphere, although he's had academic appointments. He ran the journalism program at Hillsdale for about 10 years, roughly 2000 to 2010. He is now on the faculty at the University of Lynchburg, teaching in the humanities in Virginia. He's a longtime contributor to National Review and many other publications. He very important book. I'm going to go ahead and push this book. It's Climbing Parnassus, A New Apologia for Greek and Latin. It was first published in 2002, but I think it's a justification for classical learning, for the very young, that is still apropos. All parents should be presenting this to their kids, because Tracy, are there any better stories out there than Polyphemus and Narcissus and all the rest?
Well, you can go to the Epic of Gilgamesh and so forth. There are other stories from other traditions, but I have to say I'm biased, so I'm in the Greco-Roman track.
I'm biased too. I didn't major in classics. I majored in English, but I understand the wellsprings. So I didn't say welcome. Thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Now my sense is that there is a renewal of classics, especially Latin, in American high schools, even public high schools. In recent years, am I right about that?
You are right. I haven't seen any numbers lately on it. Of course, 40-50 years ago, just about every public school of any reputation at all had Latin. That they didn't require it, but it was one of the languages, along with French and Spanish and German, that you could opt to take. And then the public schools started getting rid of it. This is around the 1970s. About the only place you could still find it at that time would have been in private schools or in diocesan Catholic schools. And then around the 70s and 80s, the Catholic schools started to get rid of it too.
I know, yep.
So we have a movement now, funnily enough, and some of this is related to the charter movement as well, but you have some public schools, a good number of them really, bringing Latin back. While it's gone, still in the Catholic diocesan schools, many of them. There's a movement for private Catholic schools. Latin is going to be very active there, but in the diocesan ones, not so much. But they might catch up with the public schools. Who knows? I hope so.
We want them. Yes, we want them to catch up. And what I've seen, just in my own experiences, a lot of secular parents, non-religious parents, want their kids to get classical education, even if it's classical Christian education, and they want that Latin starting in, at least in middle school. These are secular parents because I teach at Emory University, and I often teach freshmen and freshman comp. And one of the things that I do, we read, we talk about words a lot. We do etymologies all the time. And I end up just passing out to them Latin prefixes, Latin phrases, Latin roots even. I make them do etymology exercises, just list of words. Don't define them. Give me the etymology of them. And I've had a few of them say to me, doggone it, why didn't I get this in high school? My SAT verbal score would have gone up 50 points. I think that's absolutely right. It would have. And so the Latin must have. Just Latin vocabulary.
Well, there are many reasons to learn Latin, of course, and that's one of them. It's not the one I particularly push.
Now, Tracy, look, it's all about achievement.
Well, it depends on which road you want to take to get there. If you learn Latin in order to read Latin literature, you know, including some of the Roman historians and so forth, if you learn it in that way, then you will learn it fairly thoroughly. And all of those other benefits will come in their train. But if you learn it only to if you take a course, say, you know, Latin terminology for biomedical students, that's a course that might be well worth taking, but it's going to be limited in its benefits, really.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you the popularity. When we lived in Atlanta, my son had a good friend whose mother was a Latin teacher, a high school Latin teacher in the public schools. And out there, she teaches at a school in Gwinnett County, a big suburban county outside Atlanta. They have 4 Latin teachers in 1 high school now, and all the classes are packed. And this is a high school that is, it's not particularly high income, sort of middle. It's middle class, a mix of middle class, maybe some upper middle income. But I was astounded, because in my high school, there was no Latin. When I went to high school in the mid-70s, and this was a suburban high school outside Washington, D.C. for a few years. And then when I finished up at a new high school in North San Diego County in California, no Latin at all. In fact, they didn't even have French that I could take. So the reversal, boy, that's welcome. And I've had my son doing Latin since 5th grade, and it's a great thing.
Have you heard David Frum talk about this?
I haven't, but what does he know? He's Canadian.
Well, he in some interview, this was just amusing and it was not on topic, but he had mentioned in his high school in Canada, it came to a point, and I guess he was on a faster track because he was a smart guy, where he had to make a choice of taking either Latin or Fortran for computers. And of course, he wanted to be on the technological fast track, so he took Fortran, which a few years later didn't exist. And as he joked in his interview, he says, "Of course, no one knows Fortran anymore, and Latin is back." So he thought he made the wrong call.
Indeed, yes, yes. You know, there are in some states, state of Washington being one of them, there are proposals to not eliminate a foreign language requirement in high school, but to allow students to substitute software programming for foreign languages. That's all part of the whole STEM push. But I think that Latin, even doing it with my son, I didn't study Latin in high school, but I did French and Italian were my languages.
In a way, you did get Latin if you took French and Italian.
I certainly got the vocabulary. But there's something about Latin that is so logical and structural. I mean there's something elegant about the way you look at these words and you figure out the cases and the sentence structure. There's something beautiful about it, and I find it fun just to go over it with him. He doesn't find it so fun.
Well, he might eventually, and it does. You know, doing Latin does meet a kind of puzzle-solving instinct that some of us have. One hopes it doesn't stay there, but there is that side of it. There's something immensely satisfying, not only about figuring out a Latin sentence, but perpetrating one. When you take a Latin past a certain point, you have to do a lot of composition in it. And so you'll start, I'm talking about lower schools here, but you'll start by writing notes to your friends, a note to your mother, saying very simple things. But once you start doing that, even if you're just writing a small paragraph, you end up thinking about absolutely every word and the idea it stands for, shades of meaning. And you'll probably, if you get enough practice at this, and it wouldn't take too much, you'll probably never have problems with matching subjects and verbs in number again.
And I mean, I can see that one of the best ways to learn English grammar is to learn Latin. You have to learn your Latin grammar. Through that, you start understanding direct objects, indirect objects, in a way in English.
Sure. Well, you may know that the old English term grammar school meant Latin grammar. It didn't mean English grammar, because, you know, for the last several centuries, you learned English at home and from the local vicar and so forth. And of course, during the time of Shakespeare, you know this even better than I do, they didn't even have a dictionary for English. So the only references they had, the main ones they would use in schools, would be Latin and in some cases Greek lexicons. So that was the grammar you actually learned, mainly Latin grammar.
Did you take Latin or Greek in high school?
Yeah.
When did you start?
Oh, I started when I was around 12 or 13 or so.
Okay, so middle school, they were throwing you. Now, were you going to a Catholic school? Were you going?
It wasn't a Catholic school. It was a public school that had it.
Where was this?
This was in Kentucky.
And all the public schools had it.
I don't know about all of them at the time. This one particularly did, and the Latin teachers were especially good. Now, that's an accidental thing. You could go to the next district and find people who were not very inspired and were not rigorous in their approach. But that remains true for every subject. I mean, there are people who say that they're not good at math to this day because they had bad math teachers.
Right.
So all education is a throw of the dice.
Yeah. When you went to college, you majored in classics?
Yeah.
Where?
I was at the University of Cincinnati.
And why did you choose classics? Because you loved high school classics.
I suppose so. It's something I knew I could do. It's something I loved doing. Doing classics the way I did it led me into history and literature in the way I wanted to do. And I suppose I had vague ideas of going to law school, which meant that I didn't have to think at all about the application of anything because I wasn't going to teach it. I wasn't even going to think about it later. The book I wrote on classics, I never intended to write and just had a very good friend who encouraged me to do it. I'd gone for years not thinking too much about what classics contributed to my own mental and intellectual development. But I did keep the languages going. I did keep reading into the languages, not because it was medicinal, but because it was just something I delighted in.
Yeah. As an undergraduate, were there any particular works, classical works, that you read that really hit you hard?
I remember wanting to do nothing but poetry and history. And so anything that went under those categories, I was already prepared to love. Then I realized in order to fill in the gaps, I was made to do philosophy too, which I absolutely did not want to do. That is, reading in the original languages and being introduced to Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics that way. It was like pulling teeth. But once I got into it, I was introduced into another realm of thought altogether. And to this day, I teaching honors freshmen, I have them all read Aristotle's Ethics. Not in Greek, of course, but I have to say, there was one fellow who came up to me one day and asked me for a translation of the translation. That is the translation we were using. He's still found too difficult. It's the same phenomenon if you have ever heard a student ask you for a translation of Shakespeare.
Can you give us a modern version of this stuff? You know,
And the translation I we were using at the time was about 3 years old.
right. Foreign language. So well, and as an undergraduate, you went to graduate school in classics.
Yes. That was at Oxford,
and you studied. You narrowed things down. Did you do a dissertation in the Oxford system?
The way that worked, we had to do theses, but we had to do four of them, and they had to cover all of the areas we were concentrating on: intellectual history. I remember, you know, straight on history, and something that was more linguistic. So I had to write four of them.
And did you have to write them in Latin?
No. I did hear a lecture once in Latin, though. The fellow went, fairly slow. But that was exhilarating, too. And the practice of lecturing in Latin is not all that much in the distant past. I've met older Benedictine monks who trained at in Rome and during their theological studies, and there were some lectures that were delivered in Latin because their Italian wasn't good enough. And I don't know if you know the story of C.S. Lewis, who had a voluminous correspondence, and there was an Italian priest who wanted to write to him, knew very little English. He didn't know if Lewis knew any Italian, but he thought, well, he's an Oxford Don, surely he knows Latin. And so he wrote Lewis a fan letter in Latin, and Lewis's Latin was quite good. So Lewis answered him in Latin, and there came a nice exchange between Lewis and this Italian priest. I think that collection has been published, and you can see the Latin and of course the translations. Lewis was a tremendously astute Latinist. He really was. But this happens, you know. But that's part of the older world where, you know, you talk about my doing classics. I didn't really emphasize that in my own mind too much because I wanted a good deal more breadth in my intellectual development. So I always figured that was one side of it. I guess without knowing it, I was trying to be very old world about it. I wanted to take on board the classics, Latin and Greek, and all that they carried with them. But I wanted a much broader intellectual framework. And so here's Lewis, who'd probably never written a Latin letter in decades, was able to pick it up very fast because his training had been had been so rigorous. And of course, you're joining that to a man of his intellect too. So
I read one book by Lewis in graduate school. He was sort of on the syllabus only for one reason, and that was his book, The Discarded Image, an introduction to medieval and Renaissance literature. It was as a sort of a literary historical critic. I didn't even know about him as a religious thinker. Until much much later on, so the works. When we talk about getting young people to be excited the way you were about literature, about classical literature, what's our sell here? How do we excite them? I mean, if you're teaching Aristotle's Ethics. That can be tough to get them keyed up.
Yeah, that's not something I would put in the arena of excitement. Although it is exciting in its own way later, it's something you do because you should. But of course, early on, I was moved by the poetry and by the history. I'll say this, you know, classical education, it's a very broad category now, far broader than it used to be. But one of the essences of what you call classical education is you define your curriculum not just by what you include, but by what you exclude. And you exclude not because certain things are not valuable, but simply because they are things that you should be getting on your own. And I always say to when I go around and talk to teachers and schools and headmasters changing their curricula, I always say that we should be getting in school that which we are least likely to get outside of school, which is why you end up taking algebra and trig and calculus. Very few people are going to get that on their own. So it has to be fed early on in life, and you have to have your mind prepared for those things. And so a classical school, generally speaking, is going to be a school that is going to have very few subjects, but we'll treat those subjects with a good deal more depth than schools, say, with I don't know, offerings of 40 courses. Offering 7 or 8 is about as many courses as a classical school should try to handle, but it should handle them very well. It's not just about content, although content is extremely important in the classical approach. It's about mental formation.
You know, one of the unfortunate trends in the humanities that really started back in the 80s when a few people wrote books, you know, theorists wrote books advocating this, and that was the introduction of popular culture into the classroom. And this was presented as we're against elitism and popular culture really is more the voice of the people. and that we don't want to sound like elitists anymore. Popular culture is more multicultural, and so we've ended up with a lot more pop material in there. I mean, I have a colleague who regularly teaches a course on Harry Potter, and that's it. Harry Potter. That's the course. Maybe she gets decent enrollments, but I can't imagine too many students walk away from that class saying, wow. That's something that is an experience I could never have had anywhere else. You know, come on.
I make a distinction between elitism and elite. A classical curriculum is an elite curriculum. There's no doubt about it, in the sense that it is trying to guide you toward the highest and the best. But it's not elitist necessarily, because you can come from different social backgrounds and still get it. And in fact, if you really care about democratic opportunity, you're going to want to bring everyone up. It seems to me that when you emphasize pop culture in an academic setting, well, that's something people are going to get anyway. There's nothing wrong with it, but aggrandizing it in that way. And also, as we used to hear, every course you take is a course you don't take, or every course you take is 100 courses you don't take. You know, and so there's I have nothing against the Harry Potter thing. There are people in my institution who teach a Harry Potter course too. That's fine. I think it should be fairly low on the totem pole, because students will have already gotten that. Now, of course, they would say, well, they're going to learn a different way of thinking about it, and that's fine. But if that means you're not reading Milton or Johnson or Dickens or Jane Austen, I think there's a problem there.
Exactly. You know, Martha Bayliss, she puts it this way. There are elitist populists and populist elitists. And populist elitists are people who believe in elite material, but for everyone. Right, for all the people. Elitist populists are those who are in elite institutions, but who are selecting those popular materials because they think it shows that they're not really elite, that they're really aligned with the working classes or the underclass, which we know is kind of a fake. But we like the first one, you know. We like people who are who want Shakespeare, who think everyone can do Shakespeare, and that it will profit them in that way. So what are the courses you're teaching at Lynchburg? You're in the honors program?
Yes, or it's an honors college now, but yes, and I mainly bring in the freshmen for humanities, and this is a kind of a hybrid course in philosophy. We, as I say, we read all of Aristotle's Ethics, although we do it over the course of a term while we're doing other things. But there's a history component, there's a literature component, so we read Sophocles and so forth. We've made a curriculum change recently, but some of that is going to shift in proportions. But I even this year for the second term we read all of the Divine Comedy, and there was one girl in there who very, very smart, and she's intending to be an English major. And I told her after we finished, you're going to be working with some, perhaps some of your professors who have never read the entire Divine Comedy, but certainly some of her, most of her student colleagues will not have read it. But she got it covered in her freshman year, which doesn't mean that there's nothing more to revisit, of course. But I try to give a lot of depth to what I'm doing and give a little bit more attention to the quality rather than the quantity. It's not so many how many books we read, but how deeply we read each one.
Have you changed the works you assigned in the last 10 years for any reason? Do you see students are different, 2019, different from 2005?
Well, in 2005, I was at Hillsdale and teaching something very different. And Hillsdale didn't need my help with this sort of thing because they had such good people on their own. But I think the answer is yes. I have found myself over the last several years giving them less history. In 2012, we started on in the history component reading a good deal about Mesopotamia. And then you go to Egypt. If you've got some time, you talk about ancient China, which I find utterly fascinating. And then, and not until you've covered at least that, would you go into the Greeks and the Romans. I found myself doing less and less of that first part, not because I want to give a kind of privilege to the Greeks and the Romans, but because it's just too much information. As one student told me, and this was, and he meant this in a helpful way. He says, "You have to understand, we didn't get history; we got themes," which was his way of saying we didn't actually learn anything. We learned how to think about something, meaning how the teacher thinks about something. But once in a while, I'll make some sort of reference to some writer or some movement, whether it's Protestant Reformation or whatever it'll be. And they don't know what I'm talking about. But of course, as we know, intelligence is a constant. This isn't because they're a less intelligent generation.
No. They just the pathways that build their cultural literacy have just narrowed. I mean, just to the general background. I mean, we remember that things, you know, the a lot of the popular culture, the cartoons. Do you remember the Bullwinkle cartoon, Mr. Peabody?
No.
Mr. Peabody was this brilliant little dog, and he and Sherman, a little boy, and Mr. Peabody was this brilliant genius dog. They would go back in time. They would go to ancient Greece, or they would go to Einstein, or they would go to Vincent van Gogh. I remember one. They go back in time, and it was a funny thing, a funny take on Van Gogh. They did a whole thing about the suffering artist. You know, to be a great artist, you must suffer. So there was a lot of little satire involved, but there was an exposure to these figures that helped build up that frame, right? The context, and you'd get a lot of that in pop culture and cartoons.
Do you remember the CBS program from the 50s called You Are There?
You Are There,
and that was directed to children. So you spend a half hour listening to the founders debating the Constitution in Philadelphia or something like that, or you're there at Appomattox, and so they set it up dramatically.
Do you remember Leonard Bernstein's children's concerts, the Young People's Concerts at Carnegie Hall? Those were genuine teaching classes. I mean, he would explain things. He would go back in history. He'd talk about Mozart. And they were wonderful, and all the kids all the kids loved that. That I think over the 70s and 80s I think was when those sort of the high culture, the historical influence was just filtered out. You didn't get those old characters. Historical content just began to disappear from pop culture.
You're right. And of course it was in the 1950s with institutions like the Young People's Concerts, where they were trying to bring people into a higher echelon of experience. By the end of the 60s and into the 70s, there's a kind of corporate decision that, well, actually, pop music is really not below Mozart or Beethoven, and which sounds very good, but it means that you're going to have an impoverished generation, and they will be more and more parochialized and provincialized.
Are you saying that Mozart is better than Jay-Z? Is that what you're saying, Tracy?
Well, I've not heard Jay-Z, so I guess I should reserve judgment. I'll take a group I do know, the Beatles. I do think Mozart is better than the Beatles, and I happen to like both.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and one can say that. Yeah, sure. I enjoy that, but it's important to maintain distinctions. Anyway, Tracy, thank you for joining us, and we will we'll make sure we tell the young people to check you out when they go to Lynchburg.
Okay, it was a real pleasure, Mark. Thank you.